paper on. Oh my, why is it doing that? There we go. An expository paper on. Why is it doing this?
Because you pressed.
There we go. Pause.
No, no, that was the wrong thing to do. That will cause it to jump.
There. Okay. So, thank you. These don't work. On how symmetric monoidal closed categories turn up in lots of different situations. The Rosetta Stone itself, I guess it's not in there, was a stone tablet inscribed with the same message in three different languages. The first one was hieroglyphics, then Demotic, and then finally in Greek. At the time it was discovered, nobody spoke Demotic or hieroglyphics. They couldn't read them. But by comparing, I guess they knew seven symbols of Demotic because they were in Coptic. By comparing the Greek to what they knew of the Demotic, they were able to decipher it by making these analogies. And finally, from there to the hieroglyphics. And now we completely understand the inscriptions that are in the pyramids and so forth. And we have a similar situation in these fields, in that there's this broad analogy that crosses them. In physics, we have systems with processes mapping one system, state of a system, into another state. In topology, we have the notion of a compact manifold with cobordisms between those. In logic, these are actually groups of different logics, each set of propositions with ways to prove those propositions, and relationships between those proofs forms a symmetric monoidal closed category. And again, in computation, we have data types with programs mapping between those. And so in a programming language, once you've defined your data types and the interfaces that those have to have, you get a symmetric monoidal closed category. So in a category, we have objects, first of all. We've seen lots of different examples of diagrammatic uses or descriptions of categories. Here we have a string, it's got an arrow. Rather than follow the physics convention of going from bottom to top, we go from top to bottom in this paper. The objects of Hilbert spaces are isomorphic to, I guess in finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, they're isomorphic to the n-fold tensor product of the complex numbers. In topology, we have manifolds. In the two-dimensional cobordism case, the boundaries are all disjoint unions of circles. In linear logic, we have propositions. Now, linear logic differs from classical logic in that you don't necessarily have the case P implies P and P. If I have a ham sandwich, I do not necessarily have two of them. In computation, we have data types, and there are lots of different programming languages. Last time I gave this talk was to a computer science department, so I chose to use Java's notation. In Java, when you define a data type, you call it an interface. And set, of course, has sets. For every pair of objects in a category, there is a morphism, a set of morphisms between them. So in string diagrams, we draw a little bubble. Because we're not turning our boxes upside down, we don't use any more decoration than a bubble in this paper. Quantum mechanics, of course, has linear transformations between the Hilbert spaces, which are isomorphic to these M by N matrices. In topology, we have cobordisms. So this is the pair of pants cobordism. You start at the waist. It's a map from one circle to this joint union of two circles. Linear logic has constructive proofs that we can derive y from x. Computation has roughly programs. This is the notation for declaring a method in Java. And set has functions between them. These morphisms compose associatively. I'm just showing two of them here, but when we have three, it's clear that that we don't need to put parentheses around them when we're composing these string diagrams. Matrix multiplication is associative. The composition of cobordisms is similar. This is the first strange-looking one from a category theory point of view, in that we have this rule. The rule is part of the logic, as opposed to being the composition of deductions. An inference, a collection of inference rules, also composes, but the associativity of the cut rule here, we have what is z, x to y, x to z, composed with wx, gives us one from w to z. And associativity asserts that x to y, w to x, I suppose this should have been the other way around, but that these two deductions are equal in some sense. So we have this as part of the structure of the logic. In computation, you declare two methods, and then we can compose them like this. This is supposed to look rather like the set notation. And later I'll get into actually how composition works in lambda calculus, which is the first programming language created by Alonzo Church in 1934. And then, of course, for sets, we have this composition operator. Now, in every set of morphisms between an object to itself, we have the identity morphism. Here it's just drawn as a line. We don't draw a bubble because no need to. In this case, when you glue it on, because they're diffeomorphism equivalence classes of these things, it really is the same. It's strictly the same morphism. In quantum mechanics, we have the identity matrix, for example, on a qubit. Topology, we have this cylinder. In linear logic, we have an inference rule that says we can get a constructive proof that we can derive x from x. Now, this has a very different flavor from the other ones, again, because the other rules that turn up, for example, in linear logic with the AND, this we can interpret as a natural transformation. But back here, how do you get a natural transformation from nothing to something occurring twice? Turns out those will be dinatural transformations, and I'll get into that a bit later. In computation, you simply can write this identity function in Java, and there's the identity map in sets. A monoidal category is one where we can glom objects together to form new ones. So here we have x and x prime in parallel. Given those, we can also put morphisms in parallel and derive new ones. We write this in a couple of different ways. You can say, because we have these two in parallel, they can become a new object of the category. And similarly, these two morphisms in parallel are a new morphism. In quantum mechanics, we have a tensor product. We take tensor products of matrices, You take each element of this and multiply it by the entire matrix here to get the block. In topology, disjoint union of cobordisms. Here, this says that if we can derive x or y from x and y prime from x prime, then we can derive this new object, y tensor y prime, from x tensor x prime. In computation, we have parallel programming. Now, this is real parallel computation, not just a pair here. There's a pair type, but if one, you have to worry about the semantics, because if one of your functions taking that type to another one fails to halt, then the other one will never get executed. And so then if later you throw away the second, say this one doesn't halt, then if later you throw away the result of that, you can't ever get a result out because you had to compute this one before that one. Parallel pair says split these up onto separate processors, run them there, and then put the results back together. So you don't have to wait for the one of them to complete before doing the other. Similarly, in set, we have the Cartesian product of sets. In every symmetric monoidal closed category, there's a monoidal unit. The string diagram is nothing. In quantum mechanics, we have the C to the 1, because when you tensor matrices, you multiply their dimensions. Multiplying by 1 leaves it the same. In topology, again, we have the empty cobordism. Linear logic, I is the trivial proposition. It means I have nothing, and I can have as much nothing as I want. I can always get more of nothing. In computation, in Java, the data type is called void. In other languages, it's called the unit type. And in set, we have the one element set, I. A braided monoidal category is one where you can move objects past each other. In string diagrams, it makes sense to have one of these strings going in front of the other one. That's a braided category. This is a different morphism from if y went behind x. In quantum mechanics, we have the case where we're swapping particles around. Bosons commute, fermions anti-commute. And if you look at quantized magnetic flux tubes in thin films, you get anions. And these, when you swap them, you can have an arbitrary phase multiplier. So those really do have the braid group as their gauge group instead of the permutation group. In topology, we can put one in front of the other one. Here we have a braiding rule that swaps the derivation order. In computation, we can say, take these two data elements that are on separate processors and trade them around, and of course, the symmetric braiding on set. Braided monoidal closed categories mean that we have a currying operation. In terms of string diagrams, it means we can grab this X string here and pull it down so it becomes an output, but going backwards in some sense. This diagram here is the same as this one where I put a tilde on the F. So Y coming in and X, Z coming out. The reason we have this little clasp is that in general we can't separate X, Z into an X part and a Z part. It's only when we have a compact category where we're able to pop this bubble and drop the clasp. And so we can use this diagram for reasoning about sets just as well as reasoning about, for example, Hilbert spaces. In quantum mechanics, we have antiparticles. So here we have an electron coming in and a photon bounces off, absorbs it. Whereas when we curry it, we pull this down this way and we have a positron coming in. A photon coming in that turns into a positron and an electron. Now, this, you have to be careful about how you interpret this. It's only closed with respect to the internal state of the particle. If it were closed with respect to everything, the entire group, then an electron and a positron would annihilate each other and leave nothing behind, not even a photon. So it's only with respect to the internal state of the particle that it's closed. In topology, we can take this top part and bend it over to get this curried cobordism. In linear logic, currying is implication. If from x and y we can derive z, then from y we can derive that x implies z. This becomes a new resource type, a recipe for turning x into z. So if I have some wheat and I know how to grind it, then I can turn it into flour. So knowing how to grind is this kind of data type. Now in Java, they don't actually support this syntax, but in lambda calculus they do. So I've written it here. F of x and y can be curried into a function that takes y, returns a new function that you can apply to x. And similarly for sets, we have this exponential, the set of functions from x to z. And in sets, of course, you can't take it apart. There's no x part of the function from x to z. Now, wanted to mention a bit about dinatural transformations. So in the category cat, we have objects or categories. Structure preserving maps between categories are called functors. And then between functors, you can have natural transformations. This is a functor from C op cross C to set. So here we have two different inputs, x1 and x2. And a natural transformation consists of this front face being mapped to the back face of it. But when we have such a thing, we can consider the case where these two are the same. And there's a way around from this corner to the opposite one where we're only going backwards when these two are the same object. And this is what constitutes a dinatural transformation. So if we have something that's contravariant in one and covariant in the other, we can go this way, or we can go this way around it. And a map between those is what's known as a dinatural transformation. So here is the identity rule in the identity inference rule. We have that for any type X, we can derive a constructive proof that we can deduce a constructive proof that we can derive x from x. What this says is that if we start with the constant functor on the front face, so it just picks out the one element set, and this is that one element, then we take the identity on the front face, and then we have this map, this dinatural transformation, that picks out something from this one on the back. On the back, we have this derivation symbol, the turnstile. Usually, we can derive x from x as being a truth value. But in general, we can say it's the set of all maps from x to x. So this is the Hom functor. On x to x. So given these two objects, we get a set, and this one element maps to the identity map in that set. Going both ways around this diagram says that if we pick out the identity on y and then compose with f, because that's our Hom functor, it's the same as taking the identity on x and precomposing with f. So this dinatural transformation tells us about the left and right unit behavior of composition. And similarly, the cut rule tells us that if we post-compose with F on this one, and then compose the first two, it's the same as going the other way, and this is what encodes the associativity of composition. So these inference rules are really dinatural transformations that are encoding the structure of the category itself, of categories. Now, this is kind of a mess, but to understand how computation plays into this, there's the lambda calculus. And the lambda calculus has, as proposed originally designed by Church in the untyped version, you have variables like x, you have applications of terms, so t applied to t, and then you have abstraction, so lambda x dot t. Now you can compose these in all kinds of different ways. The idea to get arithmetic out of this, you have a function like lambda f dot lambda x dot f of x. So it takes two inputs, applies the first one multiple times to the second one. By iterating f, we get a notion of natural number. I could have just returned x, that would have been 0. This is 2, and so on. We can get these natural numbers. And then by applying them to each other, we can do things like addition. Where if I were composing FF with FFF, you just do that. And then multiplication, where instead of simply putting this after it inside the parentheses, we replace each of these with the three Fs. So doing three Fs twice would be multiplication. And then exponentiation, we do squaring twice. And that's what this diagram is doing. So here we have repeat twice, and then do that three times. And so we start out here with a long, complicated set of rewrite rules and end up with, I guess this one is doing multiplication. Had I applied 3 directly to 2 instead of composing the 2, would have got 8. But that ugly, mechanistic, long proof is exactly what we don't want to be doing, and it's why we like computers, because they take all of these little steps for us and update the term, updating the term by this rewrite rule here called beta is really updating the internal state of the computer. In Java, you write your programs, but you don't have an explicit representation of the internal state of the computer. You can't pause the computer at any point and get a Java program that represents that. Whereas lambda calculus, everything is stored in the program itself, the entire state. To get category and morphism, we have to add a notion of type to the lambda calculus, and we also have to consider equivalence classes of these terms under the rewrite rules. So our category becomes data types, equivalence classes of terms under beta. Now, once we have these categories, what do we do with them? But we can use them for talking about what kinds of structures in one get mapped over to the similar structures in the other. Here we have a category. It has two objects with two maps between them. I haven't drawn the identity. But if we relabel them somewhat, then we get this idea of the theory of a graph. We have an object representing edges, an object representing the vertices, and from each edge we can get the source vertex of it and the target vertex of that edge. So then when we consider a functor between the theory of graphs and set, well, each object V maps to a set of vertices, each object E maps to a set of edges. The morphism from E to V is a function that picks out the source of each edge, and similarly for the target. In Java, we'd write it like this. We have an interface that is this theory of a graph. It has two objects with two methods mapping from E to V. So when we typically do the semantics of a programming language, we say each data type gets mapped to a computably enumerable set of values. Integer on most systems is a set with 2 to the 32 or 2 to the 64 different values. Methods map to these partially recursive functions. But when we do model theory in the quantum case, we replace set by Hilbert spaces. And so each data type maps to a Hilbert space of values and each method to a linear transformation. And then we don't have to use programming language on the left. We can use something like the category of manifolds with cobordisms between them. And when we do this, each manifold we think of as some region of space to which we assign a space of states. And each cobordism is the space-time connecting those regions of space. And we get a linear transformation for how that state gets updated. So in the paper, you can find all the details on exactly how lambda calculus turns into something that looks like a symmetric monoidal closed category. It involves things called combinators, which I can get into if anyone's interested. But that's what I've got prepared for now. Any questions? Yeah.
As you were going through this project, you must have occasionally found examples of things which are very important in one aspect of the Rosetta Stone, but almost never mentioned in some other aspect. So some aspect of topology that clearly translates by this metaphor to logic, for example, which is nevertheless not really ever mentioned there for whatever reasons. Are there any sort of good examples of situations like that you encountered when you were thinking about this?
In the case of logic...
Not necessarily for logic.
But sure, but in that case, often they're only concerned with the existence of a proof rather than exactly how it's proved. So generalizing this to the Hom functor was something that we had to think long and hard about in order to figure out what these inference rules were. More than that, the difficulty in this paper was figuring out exactly how to get a braided monoidal closed category rather than a strict braided monoidal closed category, for instance. Doing lambda calculus in this way is very straightforward if you're doing strict categories. If you're doing weak monoidal categories, then you have to have some notion of an associator that comes into play. And there's nothing about associators in lambda calculus. We also had to worry about whether there were enough global points. A lambda term can be considered a morphism from
I into, a lambda term of type X is a morphism from I into X. Yes, thank you. So if we wanted to interpret this in the category of Hilbert spaces, a closed lambda term would just be, the linear maps between these become trivial. You don't get the entire Hilbert space by just considering these sorts of things. There are situations where you don't have enough points of this form in your category, where you're not completely capturing what the category means. And so we had to look at combinators, and Ambler was the one who completely defined the theory of a symmetric monoidal closed category in the most general case. But Abramsky has done quite a lot of work on the strict cases and various other ones. Yep.
How would the analogous look like if it were non-symmetric?
If it's non-symmetric, you mean with the logic or with?
Like the analogous and manifolds and cobordisms and on the right-hand side monoidal couple. You consider the symmetric case. What happens if you go non-symmetric, for example?
So the non-symmetric case for computation has this explicit operation B on X and Y. Your two bits of data. In the symmetric case, you can simply say that B inverse of B is the identity. So there wouldn't be a rewrite rule like this in the language. B twice. There wouldn't be a rewrite rule like this in your programming language in the braided case. So if you add in the rule like this, then the models in the other one are going to be symmetric. But in programming, you have this. And similarly, there'd be an inference rule. You wouldn't have W derives X tensor Y, W derives Y tensor X. This being the braiding inference rule. If you applied it twice, this would not be equal to the identity inference rule. And so these proofs, these deductions would be inequivalent in the braided case.
So what if you write B of Y comma X? Does that correspond to the identity or not?
Pardon?
What if you write B of Y comma X? Which of the gradings is that?
You choose one. I mean, if you say B of X comma Y, you can say X goes under Y and use that as your notation. And then B of X, Y is not equal to B of
no,
Y.
No, I mean in your syntax there, where you write B of X comma Y or something like that, just on the blackboard there. What if instead of the pair X comma Y, you write the pair Y comma X? What does that mean in your syntax? No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking to the left.
Here?
No, to the left.
Oh, this?
Yes.
This.
What if you write Y comma X instead of X comma Y?
This, I have left off the subscript. I would need to have a subscript similar to here. And so it wouldn't make any sense. It would be badly typed if I tried to say Y comma X instead of X comma Y.
Well, X, capital X and capital Y could be the same type, right?
Yes.
What if you write B of little Y comma little X as a term in your lambda calculus or in your syntax?
I'm not understanding. I'll talk to you after. Yep.
Do you have some special rules when it comes to the tensor identity? So, for example, if you have an object, a type, which is of type I, which would be the tensor identity, linear implication, something else. How would that translate to the lambda calculus? Would it be?
It would. It would be lambda star dot x, okay, where star is your unique element of the unit. So okay, in Java, you'd write f with nothing in the parentheses, yeah, and that would be a map from I to whatever. Okay. Other questions?
Okay, so let's take it off.